All right, well, thank you, and thank you for having me speak here today. I'm a plant breeder. I always tell my students this is a very exciting time to be a plant breeder because there's so many new tools available, the high-throughput genotyping, spectral canopy spectral reflectance, all these things that can help us become more efficient at what we try to do. What I'm showing up here is some of our efficiency that we have in our Ohio State program. We release about one variety every other year, and that means about one out of 300 crosses that we make actually produces a new variety. We test about 20,000 new lines a year, head rows, and one out of 40,000 actually becomes a new variety, and about one out of 3,000 that we yield test become a new variety. So, of course, you might be thinking, well, Sneller doesn't know what he's doing. That's why the percentages are so low. Well, okay, we won't talk about that. But actually, these numbers are not that different from what I've seen from some other people as well. So basically, plant breeding, it works, but it's not very efficient. So we really need to look at things that might make us more efficient. And that's the nice thing about the TCAP is it's allowing us to look into some of those. What do we do as plant breeders that make us good at what we do, but also makes us inefficient? Well, selecting parents, designing matings, creating diversity, a lot of those things are pretty much still in the realm of guesswork when we look at complex traits like yield and stress tolerance. Certainly genomic selection is going to help with some of that, we hope. Developing testable progeny takes quite a few years. I work with winter wheat. It takes me quite a bit of time. Then the phenotyping. Multiple environment trials are needed for traits like yield and stress tolerance, and we run into a lot of genotype by environment interactions. And we have a lot of that right now, but as we look through, we project what might happen in the future with climate change, I guess we can think that we'll have even more genotype by environment interactions as we get a more varied terrain of environments that we have to deal with. Then we do into our data analysis, trying to predict the future. We try to predict phenotypes to try to predict the future. We try to look at things like trait stability and select the best. And really what it comes down to is there is a lot of places where genotype by environment interactions are really a key factor and probably that reduce our efficiency dramatically. Even if we go back at the top of that list of selecting parents, that is also greatly affected by genotype by environment interactions. And yet we don't talk about them too much. Let's look at predicting the future. Here's data from two yield trials. They're grown 20 miles apart. And you can see the correlation of yield in one environment with yield in the other is 0.1. Okay, one is really not predicting the other, even though they really are quite close by, same season, same varieties. And that same trial was actually grown in 19 different environments, and that gives us 171 possible correlations between those 19 environments for yield, and the average correlation was 0.16. That's not too good. You can look there at your at the far left, Indiana battlefield, the average correlation of that location with the other 18 was less than zero. Less than zero. Okay, so there's a lot of genotype by environment interaction. So we can anticipate, though, climate change might make this even worse, assuming it could get much worse. All right. So there's a lot of things we need to look at with yield stability and genotype by environment interaction. What do we do with it? Well, actually, a lot of breeders simply ignore it. You take your data and you average over all environments, basically treating every environment like it's a random replication and saying whatever does best over everything is the best variety, and that's what you select and move on with. And that's not necessarily a bad idea. It sounds very simple, but it may actually be a reasonable approach for some type of environments. Other things you can do, though, is start to analyze your patterns of genotype by environment interactions and start to use them in selections. Look for specific adaptations if you can find certain interactions that are repeatable and certain varieties that repeatedly do better in certain types of environments. And you can characterize those environments and you can predict where those environments will occur in the future. Then you can do this. You might vary your data analysis. You can look at things like trait stability and QTL stability. In other words, you have some genetic effects that are actually very repeatable over these varied environments. And that's the ones we're going to look at today is the trait stability. Stability, there's lots of definitions. One is you grow varieties over multiple environments and their phenotypes really don't vary too much. That's a type one stability, and that's really not that practical for when we look at things like yield. Because yield is not going to be the same for any given variety over all environments. It's always going to go up and down as the productivity of that environment varies. So type 1 stability is really not that useful. So what we're looking at more is much more interest is type 2 stability. And here a genotype is determined to be stable if its phenotypic response to environmental variation can be predicted by a model. Everything's sort of relative in this approach, but at least you can start to model how these varieties respond to environmental variation and what they might yield with in the future. Type 3 is another one. It's really not very useful. It's basically saying how much do a variety's performance deviate from your model. So in other words, it's pretty much saying how much of their variation is something we can't explain. And of course, you're trying now to model things or trying to predict stuff you can't explain. Just intellectually, it doesn't make much sense. So we don't work with that one much. And actually, of all these three types, past studies have shown that type 2 actually has a bit of a genetic basis and somewhat heritable, whereas type 1 and type 3 stability really are not that useful and not that useful as a breeding goal. The other thing I want to mention here is that stability is very difficult. You have to have lots of data from lots of environments in multiple years, particularly for traits, complex traits like yield and stress tolerance. Okay, so you need a lot of data. And that makes breeding for stability very hard. In fact, we use all of our data to predict the stability of a line, and we really have no way to estimate the heritability of stability when you use all your data just to predict the values themselves. In other words, you have nothing left for an error. So, stability. Type 2 stability. One way to do this is an old approach. This was Eberhardt and Russell's approach, 1966. You're using a regression approach. You see how does the yield of a genotype in an environment, and you regress that on the average yield or the average environmental index of that environment. A typical environmental index is simply the average yield of all lines in that environment. So I show that in this the chart next to it. You see your entries, like entries 1 in the first four rows, grown environments A, B, C, and D. You have the yield of that variety in those environments under the column Y, and then in X you have the environmental yield. And you simply take those four Y values and regress them on the four axes, and you get a regression slope, which I'm calling V1 for that first variety. You do the same thing for the second variety, the third, fourth, and you get the different regression coefficients. Now here your environmental index in this example happens to be the average yield, but it could be other aspects of the environment too that you measure. One I used in soybeans was the average height of the soybeans in the different environments. And that actually was a better index of environmental value than the average yield was. But it could be other measures of stress, other environmental factors that you measure. But basically, you just do this regression. And here's just a schematic of what your results might look like. Note that here's four different varieties, B1, B2, B3, B4. And you got an average. The average slope of these all will always be 1. And stability is defined as varieties that have a slope that are close to the average. In other words, slopes that are close to 1. And what you basically have here along your x-axis, you have, in this case, the mean yield of the different varieties.
Oh, yeah, this is all being held together by a piece of tape.
Ah. This is like I designed the system. Well, unfortunately, you didn't use good tape.
Okay.
All right. All right. Next speakers, don't touch that part. So, anyways, your x-axis here is a measure of the environments. In this case, the average yield. So, basically, in this case, it's the main effect of the environments is your x factor to try to predict the yield of the varieties as you go across there. And you can think of this as a measure of stress tolerance, okay? As you get further to the left on that axis, the lower yields, that's more stress. We didn't define how the stress is, but you can work that into your models as well. But here, basically, if you have slopes close to 1, they are called stable, and slopes that deviate greatly from 1 are called unstable. I think it's important to note here that certainly unstable connotation-wise sounds bad, but in this case, you know, unstable may not be that bad. If you had high average yield and a slope of 1.2 or something, that might actually be good. But anyways, it's a measure of the environmental response, and the more different those slopes are from one another, the more they count for genotype by environment interaction. So that heterogeneity of those slopes actually models some of your G by E. Another way to try to look at a type 2 stability is to look at the additive main effects and multiplicative interaction model, the AMI model. And here you're basically modeling the main effects of genotypes, the main effects of environments. And then you use principal components on the genotype by environment interaction matrix to try to pull out a pattern of the genotype by environment interactions. Okay, and every data set you always have, there's data, there's pattern, and there's noise. And of course, the more we can pull pattern out and use it to predict the future and leave the noise behind, the better off we are. And that's basically what they're trying to do here. You got your G by E matrix. Some of that G by E is actually pattern that's useful and maybe can predict the future. And other parts is noise, and you'd like to leave that out of your model. And here's a little more detail on the AMI model. Here we have, you can see the model up there. We got the genotype main effect, environment main effect. And then right after the summation, we see a product there of three values. Those are values that come out of your principal component analysis. You try to pick up one, two, three, how many principal components you feel are important, and use those to model your G by E. And then the last part of there, the last part is just residual. That's the noise part of the G by E. So basically, principal components is taking the G by E, making pattern and noise from it. And hopefully the pattern is something that's useful. How can we use that for stability? Well, genotypes with low principal component scores through the AMI analysis have low G by E, and we'll show that in just a minute. And in your AMI, you can include any number of principal components. Our studies, we usually include one, two, or three principal components. That seems to capture most of the G by E. And then we can just sum up the absolute values. So basically what we do here is you have your model of what your phenotype is. You got a part of that G by E that's due to the genetic effects, the interaction of that genotype with environments. And from that, you can get the principal component score for that one genotype. And the higher that score is, or the greater it deviates from zero, the more interactive that variety is with the environments. So what you'd like to do is have varieties that have low principal component scores. Those would be the most stable. They'd have the least amount of interaction with environments. So we get those principal component scores, and we simply add up the absolute value, and the lower that total is, the more stable that variety is. Just to show you a quick schematic example, I just made up this schematic because it's very clear. But what we have here is three genotypes, G1, 2, and 3. And their interaction with three environments 1, 2, and 3. And what I've simply plotted out here is the principal component scores for principal component 1 and principal component 2. From here, we can actually just model and guess and see what is the interaction of the genotypes with the different environments. Let's look at genotype 1 with environment 1. Genotype 1, again, I can't find get a pointer to work here. Oh, there it is. Genotype 1, its first principal component score is 7. Environment 1, its first principal component score is 8. You multiply those together, and that first principal component models a genotype by environment interaction of genotype 1 with environment 1 of 56. The second principal component, we can do the same thing, multiply the scores of genotype 1 and environment 2, and you come up with a G by E of 15. And so the total G by E of environment 1 and genotype 1 is 71. Okay, and that's a high G by E in this little example. And the stability for genotype 1 would simply be adding up the scores, principal component 1, principal component 2 for that genotype, the score is 10. Now let's look at genotype 2 and see how it interacts with environment 1. Well, genotype 2 has a very low score for principal component 1 and principal component 2. You take those scores, which are both close to 0, and multiply them by any environment score, and the G by E is going to be close to 0. And indeed, the interaction of genotype 2 with environment 1 is only 0.5, as modeled by AMI. And the stability of genotype 2, is 0.1 by AMI. Basically, genotype 2 does not interact with the environments hardly at all, this example. It is stable. Its performance is pretty much predicted by the main effect of the genotypes and main effects of the environments. So, the objectives, and that's simply to assess trait stability in two populations. One of these is the TCAP population. Another one that we have is funded by a NIPA project. And we're going to look at stability using regression approaches and AMI. We're going to look at the correlations of our traits per se, like yield per se, with yield stability. And there's some other traits as well with their stability. And then we're going to estimate the accuracy of genomic selection to predict trait stability, because trait stability, again, using simply phenotypic measures, is very difficult to obtain because you have to have so many environments. I probably should just explain a little bit about genomic selection, because we're going to be using that later on. And genomic selection is simply a selection tool, much like phenotypic selection, except it goes faster because you kind of skip the phenotyping. Here is simply a schematic of doing phenotypic selection. You start with parents, you cross them, you get F2s, inbreed, you get progeny, go through the whole breeding process, phenotype them, get the best ones, start over again. For us in winter wheat, for yield, that takes about 7 years. With genomic selection, we get to that F2 stage, we would have built a model based on markers that would allow us to predict the phenotype of those F2 plants. That phenotype could be for yield, it could be for yield stability, quality, disease resistance, anything. We build a model that allows us to use markers to predict the value of individuals. Just show a little more detail. The top box there, we have our beginning up here with a training population. This is simply a set of your desired lines. For our case, one of them was the TCAP elite panel for soft winter wheat. We phenotype those. In our case, we phenotype them from yield and yield stability and some other traits, and their stability of those traits as well. And we also genotype that population with markers scattered out throughout the whole genome. That creates thousands and thousands of markers. We use that phenotypic data then and genetic data together to build a model that predicts the value of individuals. We then select the best lines and cross them to get F1s. We self those F1s and get F2s, which is down here. Each of those F2s is then genotyped. Their genetic data is fed into that model, and we can predict the phenotype of those individuals based on that genomic selection model. From there, we can select the best F2s, cross them, and start a new cycle. And with genomic selection, then we can just go through this cycle time after time without doing the phenotyping. All right? And this, of course, is very important for a trait like yield stability, which otherwise is very difficult and very time-consuming to phenotype. So, materials and methods. We had, in the TCAP population, we have 273 soft wheat lines that we actually genotyped. These were grown for yield in 12 environments, Ohio, Virginia, Kentucky, Missouri, 2 years, one or two reps each in augmented design. We looked at traits like yield, test weight, heading date, and plant height. We did AMI and regression stability for each of those lines. And then we did genomic selection using cross-validation. And this population was genotyped with the 90K SNP chip. The other population consisted of 470 soft wheat lines. These were grown in only 6 environments, and all in Ohio, so not nearly the diversity of environments. Again, everything else is pretty much the same, except we looked at only yield in this population. Here's our results. What we have here is our yield of all the environments when we only had 6 environments, a fair range of environments. Some are high-yielding environments, some are low-yielding. Same when we had the 12 environments. Our genotypes yielded quite differently, so there's a lot of genetic variation for that. And there was pretty good variation for our stability. AMI in 6 environments, we had a fair range of AMI stability, and even larger range of AMI stability when we looked in the 12 environments with the TCAP population. And again, we had nice variation for the stability parameters using regression in both populations. Modeling G by E variance, because the AMI approach and the regression approach both model your G by E, basically partitioning into a pattern versus noise. So in this case, the pattern part captured by AMI was always greater than what we captured when we looked at the regression. In fact, regression is a sort of a submodel of AMI. So you would expect AMI actually to capture more because it does regression and then some. All right. So the AMI does model more of the genotype by environment interactions, and that was true for every trait we looked at, whether we looked at 12 environments or 6. Yield and regression yield stability, they were fairly independent. This was looking at the both populations, the 280 lines and 12 environments at the top. You can see there's really no correlation there of yield along the x-axis and stability based on regression along the y-axis. The ones in the red box, those are lines that would be defined as being high yielding and stable. And of course, those are things we'd like. And you can see the same when we looked at 470 lines. Again, no correlation between these two traits. And we looked at yield with AMI stability. And again, no correlation between yield along the x-axis and stability along the y-axis for either one. And again, there's in the box, you see some lines with high yield and also fairly stable performance. In this case, there's those lines because they have low AMI stability or low AMI stability scores, so meaning they are stable. Those ones, basically, you can predict their performance pretty much from the main effects of environments and main effects of genotypes. They are not interacting much with environments. And AMI and regression stability themselves are fairly independent. I don't know what happened in that first graph. There should be 280 dots in there, but there obviously aren't. But the idea is the same. I don't know what happened to all the other ones. It looks like about 200 are missing. But the idea is the same. The correlation is, again, very close to zero. But you see things that you could, within those red boxes for both populations that are, would be deemed stable by either measure. What did genomic selection do for these? Well, we looked for genomic selection for yield and yield stability in this graph here. And this is basically the correlation of our observed trait values versus that predicted by the model. So we have a yield over the 12 environments. For yield per se, not yield stability, the correlation was about 0.33. We looked at AMI stability. The correlation was actually 0.44. And using regression stability, it was also fairly high. All right, that would suggest that stability here, by either measure, was actually fairly heritable. Okay, because our genetic model, based on additive effects, is actually predicting the value of these individuals. So it must be under genetic control, because that's all the model can do, is model genetic effects. When we look at six environments, actually our prediction of values for yield per se and yield based stability based on regression are very high. There's not a mistake there. There is no red bar. The correlation of here predicted values and observed AMI stability was less than zero. And basically, the genetic models could not predict AMI stability at all here. Looking at a few other traits, test weight from the data collected over 12 different environments. Again, genomic selection was pretty good at estimating the value of test weight, but also test weight stability. And for height and heading date, again, we have GS models predicting the traits themselves, but also predicting trait stability at a pretty high level, particularly if we use the regression approach. AMI, again, did not show up quite as well. And we looked at regression prediction. So basically, from those quick slides here, regression stability looks to be fairly heritable and something that genomic selection can actually model fairly well. So if we looked at our population of 280 lines and actually plotted out some of the ones that with the highest regression slopes and some with the lowest regression slopes, and variety B that would have the average regression slope, these are the responses that we predict. Certainly as average yield of the environments go up, the yields go up. In other words, as you get less and less stressed, yield goes up. But down here at some of the low yield environments, more stressful environments, variety C would look like it'd be best. And we get to the high yield environments, variety A starts to look better. So, and remember that we had no association of yield and stability based on regression. So you could probably pick some lines with high yield and fairly flat slopes. That means they probably yield fairly well across many environments and are fairly stress tolerant. So, conclusions. We certainly saw good genetic variation for stability using either the AMI approach for certain traits and using the regression approach. Trait stabilities themselves seem to be fairly independent, so you could select for high yield and yield stability, test weight and test weight stability, other traits and their stability as well. AMI, while it seemed to model more the genetic G by E variation, unfortunately it didn't seem to be quite as predictable as we did when we have a regression. But certainly stability using regression approach, and sometimes AMI seems to be under genetic control. Genomic selection can model those. The regression approach, again, produced estimates of stability that seem to be more predictive, that genomic selection was better able to predict those. And it'd be interesting to look at what other measures and environmental indices you could use. We use the average for those traits, but you could also use any other sort of measure of environmental effects. So, with that, I am done, and I'm happy to take any questions.
So we have time for questions. Yeah.
So, George, let's say that you have varieties that are responding well to the environment. So we have higher spreads, lower sheaves, lower spreads, higher yield. You have that variety, let's say, well, the alpha error is fine, but 90% that is an exceptional variety that will perform well under spreads and equally well. So the stability of that variety will be bad. Then you don't want to select for stability.
Well, with the regression approach, in the literature they call it, the slope is close to one, it's called stable. And again, if it's deviated from one, it's called unstable. But I'm not sure, again, the connotations is unstable would be undesirable. But I'm not sure that's necessarily true. I think here we're simply characterizing their responses and showing that the responses are not all equal and that the differences in response are actually partly under genetic control. So I would, again, I've stuck with the literature saying stable and unstable, but we probably should think it's in better terms than that because unstable is not necessarily bad when you're looking at the regression slopes. So
your regression models were able to account for about 10% of the GLA area?
About 10 to 15% is usually what they did, yes.
And what was the AMI or AMI?
The first
model,
what's that?
And what was the AMI or AMI model able to account for in comparison?
Usually the first principal component accounted for about 19 to up to 34% of the variation. It depended on traits in the data set. But almost, in fact, every case, the first principal component in the AMI always accounted for more of the G by E variance than did the heterogeneity of regression slopes.
So apparently it's pulling the noise out of the data in those PCs?
Well, you think maybe it's pulling the, you know, it might be pulling some noise into it, yes. That'd be my guess. And that's why it seems to be under less genetic control. Genomic selection wasn't able to predict AMI stability very well, suggesting that, of course, it's not under genetic control, which suggests that those principal components are pulling noise in, not all pattern as we would like it to do.
So that's what we're talking about in the literature, then. The literature would suggest that AMI is more effective at pulling variation out.
Well, it's more accurate at modeling variation. Whether it's predictive variation or not, it doesn't look quite as clear now.
Two questions. One is there enough variation in phenology in these lines that the level of stability is partially just an effect of whether it's early and late? I think the sort of a classic example where early lines were stable. Mm-hmm. And then the second question is whether a fundamental problem, and this seems to be this black box approach to environments, and I know Mark Cooper and Scott Chapman did emphasize, you got the wrong environmental conditions, that negative correlation may mean you're driving your selection backwards from where you want to go.
Yes, I would say that probably the variation phenology, while there is some there, it's not that great. These are all lines pretty much selected to be adapted to that region. And so we're probably looking at a range of heading dates of probably 10 to 15 days. We didn't find that to be correlated to yield or to stability either. So, and yeah, the black boxes, I would certainly agree with that. I mean, the way we characterize our environments basically on their average value for those traits is very much a black box approach that we should do much better on.
Is there anybody in the team cap that's looking at the concept of target populations environments, the terminology that
Mark and Scott use? I'm not really sure we are. I mean, we are looking at under very controlled drought versus irrigated, high nitrogen versus low nitrogen, but just in that very broad sense. Yeah. Were there any more questions, or do we have time?
Follow up on that. For your three lowest yield environments, do you know what the yield limiting factors were? Were they the same across all three?
No, again, we do not characterize those environments well enough to really say exactly what happened to those. So no,
one could be disease pressure, the second environment might be low nitrogen, the third environment might be drought.
We have different fields. Right. Almost certainly was not disease, because all these trials were sprayed with fungicides, so disease pressure should have been very minimal. But it could have been nitrogen, it could have been certain other factors as well. So we have to dig into that data and see more about that. So it's not necessarily nitrogen, because actually one of the lower nitrogen sites, there were some low nitrogen sites in there. One of them actually ended up yielding very well. So.
All right, well, thank you very much, Clay.
Sorry, I think we're out of time.
One more question.
Okay, one more.
Sorry, do you think that the predictive ability of GS would increase with more environment? It looks like you had 6 and 12. A commercial breeding program, maybe 100 different environments.
Well, it should be, because you should get a better estimate of the genotype by environment interaction and stability. You just think about doing a regression. You know, we did our one regression, we only had 6 values along the x-axis. That's just not enough. So actually, I was quite surprised that GS could predict it at all. In fact, we weren't going to do it, but I said, well, let's go ahead and try it. And it did predict it, which, again, I was surprised, because I didn't think we'd get very accurate estimates of stability with so few environments. But yeah, more environments is always better.
All right, well, thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.